We looked last week at the idea of the problem of looking at things that occur in the world, specifically looking at this situation, and then trying to understand what are we supposed to understand by looking around the corner. In other words, when looking at a physical event, object or phenomenon, we have to understand that that's only skin deep. Just like when you consider a person, a friend, or someone you've been married to for 50 years, and what you're interested in is not what you see on the surface. What you're interested in is what you can't see. That's what being human means. That's what being human means, and that's the special trick of being Jewish, is that our whole life is there. When you know someone well, we've pointed this out many times before, when you know someone well, if you think about it, you'll realize that it's a very striking fact that no matter how intimately you know them, you never actually see them. All you see is the physical aspect of what they are. The mystics would say maybe the piece of meat that carries them around through the world. That's what you can see and experience directly. But the human being, the person is inside, you never make contact with directly. The closest you ever get is by trying to interpret the actions of that very crude, what the mystics call a kli, that vessel or tool that the real person inhabits. Which means that the trick of reaching consciousness of a higher reality, which is really what makes us different from the rest of the world, the rest of the physical world, is to be able to look at something that looks physical but understand that inside there's something that's not. Of course, this simple fact most of the world has missed. Most of this generation, Jewish and non-Jewish, has missed the fact that there is something inside. When they think that the outside is the same as the inside, the outside looks like a gorilla. So inside is the same thing. Whatever makes a gorilla tick is what makes you tick. And actually they've got an ideology about that, that says just that, and they try to live that way also. You don't need to look far to see that. But the whole point of trying to get anywhere spiritually is to be able to see that which can't be seen. So we tried to look last week at how we do that with regard to this specific situation. Let's look this week at the root of this idea. Now, let's try and look. Monday night is supposed to be, it's called Judaism and Mysticism. So let's try and look at the transcendent roots of this idea. Let's try and study it together. We went through some of these ideas a year ago, 2 years ago. Let's try and understand it now with what we said last week in mind, and try and see how deep we can understand this title. The problem is, if you look in the deeper writings, they write about what's called nes and teva, which means miracle and the natural world. Let's say normality and the miraculous. And it's a tension between those two, which is what we have to understand. We're not looking to understand miracles right now, although we'll talk about that also. But what we want to understand is simply the fact that when we say miraculous, when we say that word, nes in Hebrew, we mean something that's invisible to the normal physical eye, but it's the most obvious level there is to the refined, sensitive, spiritual eye. But the word nes in Hebrew doesn't actually mean a miracle at all. The Hebrew word nes means a banner or a flag. It's kenesa la giva, like a banner on the hill. It means something you see clearly around which you can rally. In other words, when you're lost and you see a sign, a beacon, but that indicates something clearly that you didn't know before. That's what we understand as miracle, what a miracle is. When a nes occurs, when the physical world turns itself upside down, which we don't merit to see anymore, not at least in the revealed sense. We have to see it in the hidden sense, which is what we want to talk about. When the world does that, so then you have a banner, you could see something clearly that you couldn't see before. It's this concept that we have to try and see even in what looks natural. But we have to try and see that transcendent reality that the physical eye can't see. We have to try and see that in what is only physical. It's a very difficult and challenging subject. Again, the problem with the subject and why it's so difficult to talk about is that the level we want to reach here is a level that really can't be spoken about. If it could be put into physical words, then it could be manifest in the physical world also. If you could take a human soul and you could speak clearly in words what that thing is, then you'd also be able to see it in the world. Because words are just another physical parts, pieces, fragments of the physical representation, the physical manifestation. Which means that if something can't be perceived by the physical senses, it can't be put into words. You can use words, but they only talk around the thing. And those words are only clear to the one who's already an initiate, who knows what the words mean because he knows it already without the words. Then the words could help maybe show him a new angle, or the person who's almost an initiate could maybe be just bumped in to an area that he hadn't quite fallen into before, but he has to be very close already. To take someone who doesn't understand and say the words will never convey. A simple analogy would be, just to make it graphic, have you ever had the experience of trying to teach somebody a skill? Ever had that experience of trying to teach somebody a knack, let's say in sport or something? Well, you never can convey a knack to somebody else. You can hold their hands and take them through the motions. You could show them movies and diagrams, and you could demonstrate it hundreds of times. But that thing that we call a knack, that thing which is how a thing just clicks and feels right, that you just can't put into words. The only way a person can ever get that is when they get it accidentally by themselves. So what you do by teaching is you show them until you get them close enough so that they can accidentally get it right one time. Is that right? And once they accidentally get it right, it's amazing how the women always understand. Amazing. I'm still asking the question, they all say yes. And then unless they're just being polite, I don't know. That's how you convey a skill. You get the person close enough, and then when they get it by themselves, they understand immediately and totally what the thing is. Of course, they couldn't convey it to somebody else either. And then they can't understand why it took you so long to explain this thing to them that's so obvious. But that's what it is. That's the nature of things that can't be expressed in words. We've discussed this also in many different ways before. The idea of looking at the physical and seeing something inside that's not physical, that's exactly that subject. Since you can't put it into words, you can't convey it, and no amount of looking at the physical will show you. Because no matter how much you look at a tree, you won't see anything other than a tree. In the mystical writings, when they tell you that a tree is a spiritual being, that when you look at it sensitively enough, you will see a higher reality, but they mean only to speak to somebody who knows what they mean already. But if somebody doesn't know what they mean, who stares at a tree for 6 hours in a row, concentrating very hard on the tree, will only see a tree. It might be nice and relaxing, it might be that kind of meditation, but he won't see anything higher. It's a special kind of looking. It's a perception that needs to be understood from a much deeper root. You have this problem always, even if you study the offshoot of Kabbalistic wisdom, which is Eastern wisdoms. The Eastern wisdoms are the closest system in the world to the Kabbalistic roots, right? It says that Abraham sent his children, a certain group of his children, sent to the East to teach the mystical wisdom. If you study their systems and you see where they talk about these experiences, where they talk about meditation, for example, they talk only to the initiates. If you read the Kabbalistic wisdom, you'll see the same thing. The talk is only for those who understand already, because you can't say it for those who don't. You'll see in those systems, for example, they talk about meditation as being a system where you switch off the mind. But meditation isn't switching off the mind. What they mean is switching on the mind. Why do they say switching off the mind? If you switch off the mind completely, that's not, you don't reach a meditational level, you become a zombie. That's what happens if you switch off the mind. If you sit with the mind switched off, it's not meditation. Again, it's a wonderful form of relaxation, maybe, but it's not meditation. Meditation is switching on the mind. Anybody who's ever read anything Eastern will be struck by the paradox between the... If you read carefully, you'll see they tell you that in order to meditate, you must switch off the mind. But on the other hand, they tell you that if you do that, you will reach a consciousness. You will reach a consciousness of the oneness of the universe. Your consciousness will flow into the consciousness, etc., etc. All those Kabbalistic terms, which they just translated into Sanskrit. But that is what it is. But what they mean is, they don't mean switch off the mind. What they mean is switch off the external mind. Switch off the mind that measures physically. That's what they mean. Switch off that part of the mind that limits the inner mind. It's the outer part of the mind, which we spoke about a few weeks ago, I think about a few months ago, just before the break, the last subject that we discussed under the heading of Emuna, which was the subject of Das. We discussed the idea that there are two aspects to the mind. An outer aspect, which measures in physical terms, the mathematical side of the mind, the side that interfaces with the senses. Then there's an inner aspect of the mind, which knows things intrinsically, right? Like your own existence, and many other examples we gave then. That aspect of the mind is stilled and quieted when the external mind functions. When the mathematical mind is functioning, the infinite mind cannot function. But they can't explain that in so many words, so they tell you that you have to switch off. They don't mean switching off, they mean exactly that switch. But the way you switch on is by switching off the mechanism that blocks it. But they put it in a way that's very elegant and eloquent for those who understand already. Those are some of the problems, some of the ideas behind why we have trouble talking about these subjects. To complicate the matter is the fact that the inner world, which is what we want to try and perceive this evening, at least the direction, and the outer world, the problem is that the one hides the other completely, but the problem is that it reveals it exactly. That's the problem. The problem is that when you look at a tree, you have to look at the tree. When you look at a tree to see the inner being of what a tree is in the world, to look at the tree with the external mind will never show an internal reality. It can't do that. But to look at a tree and not see the tree, they're definitely not going to trigger the internal depth. That means a person has to look at the external reality, but they have to understand how to switch the external signs into internal meaning. That's the trick that has to be done. That might sound impossible, might sound a very unfair ordeal, but if you think about it for 2 minutes, and again we've been into this before, you'll see that you have a natural gift in this field, in the most important area that there could be, which is when you have to understand what a person is, you see you have a natural gift that enables you to look at an external form and understand intimately and immediately an internal being. Unless you are really part of a secular culture where you really relate to people as gorillas. If you really relate that way and you're not prepared to think any further, then of course all this is meaningless. But if you have some inner inkling that there is something inside a person that isn't inside a monkey, then you know that when you look at a person, even though you only see the physical, as one great Rosh Hashiva said, he said you never see beyond the tip of someone's nose. What he meant was you never see beyond skin deep. That's all you can ever see. No matter how deeply you look into someone's eyes, but you'll never see deeper than the physical reality. The way that you have to know what's beyond, what's beneath that physical thing, is by switching the physical into what's not physical. The example, what's easy to understand is this. When you relate to someone physically, you talk to someone or you watch them, what you're thinking of and what you're understanding, especially women are especially talented at this naturally, and it comes through an ability to not intellectualize. I'm not saying women cannot intellectualize. And many women are around much more brainy than most men. But women have an ability to know a thing intrinsically without confusing it with the intellectual version of the same thing. Men often have been trained and have a natural ability to put the intellectual level first as a filter through which intrinsic knowledge comes, and therefore they won't accept the thing intimately and intrinsically unless it makes sense in the external mind. It's a tremendous block that men have to teach themselves out of through meditation. Be that as it may. It's a long, deep issue in its own right. But when you relate to someone, what happens is the only way you get to know who they are is by observing carefully every nuance of movement of what the physical vessel does. Every movement of the muscles of the face is your clue to what is happening inside that person, to who they really are intrinsically at a level that you can't grasp in words. What they say, what they do and what they say are all physical manifestations. Did it ever strike you that when you were listening to somebody talk to you, all you were experiencing is the vibration of sound, the vibration of air molecules impinging on your eardrum? Is that right? The experience is, it's very embarrassing to break it down. In their two pieces of tissue in their throat are vibrating. That's generating vibration in the air molecules. That strikes your eardrum and that tickles some hair cells in your inner ear and that sends nerve impulses to you. That's what's happening. It's a very, very physical experience. But while you're listening to that person say something intimate to you, that's the last thing you're thinking of. Unless you're twisted in some way. But or you spent too long at medical school like me. But in other words, you have a natural ability to translate the physical experience into a spiritual experience. Is that right? When somebody smiles at you, or when somebody gives you something you need. Let's say you're in trouble, you have a need, and that person takes something of theirs that they need, and they give it away and they give it to you. Really what you're experiencing is a hand, just like a monkey's, no different at all, moving through space, the muscle twitch just like a monkey's. They're quite right about that. The external world, there is no difference. And an object moves through space and it transfers from one person to another. But nothing spiritual about that at all. And yet your reading of that situation, the way you inwardly experience that situation, is the last thing in your mind, the physiology of muscles moving and objects transfer. What you understand is an intimate experience of generosity and intimacy and love and warmth and so forth. All these things that can't be represented in the physical. So what we understand is this, that all you have to do is open yourself, become sensitive to what's happening when two people interrelate, no matter how intimately or otherwise. When two people relate to each other, what's happening is a physical tool is being used in order to convey something that automatically is switched into your inner consciousness. How that happens, you never could put into words. How that actually happens and how you understand, right, that's the das, like we said, you know what's happening inside that person. How you know it, you never could put it into words. But an inner experience of what's inside them and what makes them who they are, you are reading only through seeing the physical objects mutate. Now, the next detail is this, that the only way into the inner world is through the tool of the outer world. That's the only way in. If they don't have a face with which to express those nuances of expression, or a voice to speak to you, or a tool, a body that can do the actions, so then you never can have access. But the only way you can get in, it's a remarkable thing, that stuck in this world, we're subject to needing the vessel of this world, even though it's so crude and coarse that it can be confused with the monkeys, and has been and is, but that's the only tool with which you can operate in order to get to the inner world. So you have to know how to use it right. Looking at a tree, it is the tree that teaches you what a tree is. It's not something else. It is the tree. It's every detail of what a tree is. But you have to know how to translate it from the physical thing into that inner experience. And that takes an intuitive ability which is built by meditation, Kabbalistic study, Torah study in general, being sensitive to people. It's because this switch isn't working that modern society is able to look at the external world and think that that's the entire world. And it's why people torture each other in marriage, for example. There are marriages and other human relationships where people manifest torture on each other. And that's because they're unable to relate to the inner being of the person that they're with. The person could understand, put themselves, could understand that what's being conveyed here, not just a physical experience that will one day decompose, but it's the inner being that you're trying to experience directly. People would understand that, so then it would be such an intimate experience, first of all, that a person would never ever be sad again, and secondly, that a person would never hurt anyone, because the pain of anybody else's emotion would be felt by you immediately. That's the most aspect of this thing. Now let's try and understand this pathway. Let's take an example. Let's start with an example. Let's take the example of a miracle. If what we've said is true, it must be that something that's called a miracle must actually be natural. Stay with me, you have to hear well. What we're saying is this, that something that we call miraculous is an insight into the hidden world. That's what it is. It's a banner that's raised. Suddenly the sea splits, or something that can't be explained happens, so you have to acknowledge that the physical rules aren't the physical rules. And so you have to acknowledge it's something else. But it only happens through the tools of the physical world. Miracles happen when they do. Today they happen in a hidden form. We have to try and explain this. Whether they're revealed or hidden, they are a manipulation of the objects and phenomena in the physical world. And therefore, the only way, again, you see into the hidden world is by understanding what's happening to the objects. But not only in the mystical writings, it points out, by the Machshava, they point out, that a miracle isn't only natural objects moving themselves in an unnatural way, but even the way that they move themselves is natural, if you understand it correctly. It's confusing. Let's understand it clearly. One of the Talmidim of Rav Dessler brings down from Rav Dessler the following idea, which illustrates it beautifully. He points out, and if you've got a scientific background, this is even more clear to you. You don't have to have a scientific background, but if you do, it should be. If you have a rigorous scientific training, you'll find this as clear as anything and almost impossible to accept. What can I tell you? Stay with me. A miracle is defined in spiritual terms as a change in an order of frequency. That's all. That's all it is. It's not something that, you have to understand, a miracle is not something that something impossible happens. That's not what happens. All that happens is something that changes its frequency of occurrence. try and understand. There are two classes of miracles. Okay, we're discussing tonight the natural and the miraculous. By miraculous, we mean miracles, and we mean the whole inner world, that whole spectrum. There are two classes of miracle. One, what we call a nais nesta. Nais nesta means a hidden miracle. We mentioned some aspect of this not so long ago also. Then we have what's called a nais nigla, which is what's called an open miracle. The difference would be that a hidden miracle would be something that's not physically impossible, it's just very, very unlikely. That would be what's called a hidden miracle. Very unlikely. But it happened exactly at that time, let's say, for example, unlikely in time. Or unlikely in terms of the concurrence of a number of physical phenomena that very seldom come together. But nothing that's impossible. And then you have what's called a nais nigla. A nais nigla is a miracle where the thing is so openly revealed that it breaks the law of nature. Not just the frequency, but it breaks a law of nature. Let me, a simple example would be, a nais nesta, a hidden miracle would be, let's say, I think we used this example last time, let's say you go for a jog someplace out in the country, and you don't realize that you're jogging towards the edge of a cliff, and you fall over. And 5,000 feet below you is a jagged, rocky end. And as you're falling, you clutch onto a small twig that's growing out of the side. You have to put some drama to this series. You clutch onto a twig that's growing out of the side of the cliff. And as you hang onto this twig, it starts to pull out of the cliff face. And within a second or two, you are about to become part of the scenery. Now, at that moment, as it's just about to tear out, it just so happens that there's somebody up on the edge of the cliff that day who's practicing throwing ropes over the edge of cliffs. And you catch onto the rope and he pulls you up. Now, there's nothing miraculous about that. That's a completely natural set of circumstances, but if it happened to you, you'd be very impressed. You might consider for a few moments, I guarantee it wouldn't last more than a minute, but for a few moments you'd consider changing your lifestyle, you'd consider going to shul the next day, and you know, for a couple of minutes you'd probably... But that's the idea, that's a nice nesta. In other words, it's a clear miracle, right? Clearly in the category that's called miraculous. Actually, if you think about it further, you'll realize that everything's miraculous. Because the fact that you take the next breath that you take is every bit as great a miracle as that. In fact, if you go into it statistically and what's involved in the mechanism, it's far greater miracle. The only problem is we just handle with lack of excitement what we're used to, that's all. The way Hashem fools us, I have to understand this deeply, the way Hashem fools us about the world, it just gets us used to things. It's not whether the thing's more or less miraculous, it's irrelevant. He just gets us used to a certain order, such that when it changes, that's when we get excited. But the Gemara says, for example, that the resurrection of the dead is much less wonderful than the birth of a child. That's what it says. Because the birth of a child, the Gemara says clearly, when the dead are resurrected, it will be people put together from components that once were together. But a child is formed out of components that never were together. The Gemara says it's like a king who ordered, I think we mentioned this, a king who ordered his subjects to build him a palace out of bricks and stones and wood and so forth, and they built him a palace. And then he ordered them to build a palace out of water. And out of water they made a palace of brick and stone and wood. The Gemara says, obviously that's much more wonderful. So that's the birth of a child. A child is born from water, whereas the dead are resurrected from components that once were here in the world. But we don't respond to it that way. The Gemara proves it with many other proofs. It goes through a lot of... And it just talks about the resurrection. It's fascinating. But we don't respond that way. When the child is born in the world, we don't start jumping up and down with excitement about miracles. We say, Mazel Tov, another child's born. But if you were sitting next to the cemetery, and the ground started to shake, and a few bones put themselves together, then... this is very hard for the scientific mind to accept, but it's rigorously, logically true. It doesn't take any. In other words, what we have here is this. That you have an order of frequency. You have things that happen in the world in a certain way. And because you're used to their happening in that way, so you don't define them as miraculous. But of course the wisdom is to see that the frequency is irrelevant. It's just that Hashem is doing things that way, so you shouldn't take notice to give you an opportunity to live the way you're supposed to live, which we'll come to in a moment. The other kind of miracle is what's called an esnigle, which means where nature does do something impossible, where a thing falls up instead of down, where the sea, instead of being horizontal, the sea stands vertical. That's called an esnigle. We don't see that today. After the generation of prophecy, from the time of the destruction of the second temple, the last 2,000 years odd, we don't see that kind of miracle. But that kind of nes, the Baalei Mashoba explained, and it's straightforward as well, from a scientific point of view, is also only a change in frequency. Because a scientific law is not a law, it's just a description of frequency. Are you with me? A law of science, the uninitiated layman who doesn't know anything about science, thinks that a law of science means a thing has to happen that way. Gravity says that things must fall down. So the uninitiated thinks it means a thing must fall down. But gravity doesn't mean that a thing must fall down. It never meant that. No scientist who knows what he's talking about will tell you that. Gravity is just an observation that every time we drop a thing, it falls down. So therefore we phrase a law that on the basis of all observed phenomena, are you with me? Things fall down. But a scientist who's rigorously honest will tell you that it doesn't mean that the next time you drop something, I'm not going to do it. The next time you drop something, it won't fall up. It certainly could. The only difference is if it fell up, we would rephrase the law. That's all we would say. Things usually fall down. Except once in a great while, things fall up. In case you think I detect a note of skepticism in the laughter. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you a straightforward scientific example. It happens often in science. If you make a set of observations and phrase a law, you'll see that this is exactly what happens. First of all, in subatomic physics, which is a fascinating area, this happens in a different way, which is fascinating, provides fascinating insights into it. But if you take simple, observable, macroscopic physical phenomena, I'll give you an example. If you take any substance, any liquid known to man, and you freeze it, you cool it, from its boiling point down to its freezing point, you find it contracts. The cooler it is, the more, you know this, right? It contracts. Let's say you did an experiment to phrase a law about expansion and contraction. Let's say you gathered together in the world every known liquid imaginable, and you checked, you measured its volume, and you cooled it by 1 degree increments or decrements until it was frozen, and you measured its... Are you with me? What you'd have is a straight line graph, to the best of my knowledge, for all known substances. They all, at least, they contract with temperature. The cooler you make them, the more they shrink. Imagine you did it with 5 billion substances in the world. Right? Everything you could lay your hands on, you checked and it did that. Wouldn't you phrase a law? Wouldn't you say that substances, when cool, contract? Is that right? But it just so happens that when you test water, you'll see that it does the opposite. Water contracts from 100 degrees down to 4 degrees. And from 4 degrees down to 0, it starts expanding. Imagine you'd done everything in the world and water down to 4 degrees. What would you bet? What would you bet that it was going to carry on contracting? As a scientist? As an intelligent, level-headed, modern Westerner, you'd probably bet everything you have. Huh? And yet when you start to cool water, it does exactly the opposite. So what's the law of cooling with things? Substances cool, contract when cooled, except water. From 4 degrees down, starts expanding. It doesn't bother anybody. It's called the anomalous expansion of water, and no scientist is bothered by that. That's the law. Are you with me? Therefore, scientist isn't bothered at all by the fact that all objects fall down, except once in a while, certain objects fall up. Do you follow? I mean, scientifically, emotionally, he would be a little startled. But a rigorous scientist would just go back and... Are you with me? I'm not pulling the wool over your eyes. It's straightforward, standard scientific thinking, isn't it? Which means that a law of nature... Of course, you realize that these things happen for a reason. I'm just going to point that out as an aside. Now, this is what we should really talk about. This is religious and spiritual. Not mystical, which is more important. But I'll just mention it as an aside. You know why water breaks the rules? You know why it breaks the rules? The Baalei Mashoba say, why did Hashem do that? He doesn't like to break the rules. It says in all the mystical writings that he avoids miracles like anything. Because a miracle takes away your free choice. It makes you realize that there's something deeper to life, and we don't want you to realize that. We want you to figure it out for yourself. Hashem wants you to figure it out for yourself, so he doesn't show you. But occasionally he breaks the rules for a very important reason. Why does water expand? Because when a substance expands, it becomes less dense. And therefore water, which becomes ice, is less dense than water that's liquid, which means ice floats, right? Which means that rivers and oceans and lakes freeze from the top down, not from the bottom up. Because if rivers and oceans froze from the bottom up, there would be no summer the next summer. Nothing would be alive, because everything would be frozen to death from the bottom up, solid block of ice, and the next summer, nothing left. So what happens is he freezes ice in such a way that the ice floats and seals the surface. Ice is a very good thermal blanket. Snow's even better. Very, very crafty. Not bad for a couple of million years of accident. What happens is it seals the surface of the water, trapping the heat inside, so that the fish live quite happily in the winter. And next summer, the world carries on. It's very crafty. That's what happens. But that's another story. Now, what do we have? What we have is this, that a law of nature is not a law like a human law that you must do something. It's just a description of frequency, that's all. That if we do this thing very often, we see this and this and this. Which means a miracle that breaks the law of nature is not breaking any law. It's just changing the order of frequency, that's all. Are you with me? It's no less natural. Is that right? It's no more natural or less natural that water stands this way than water stands that way. The only thing is, usually it goes that way. But again, the only difference is that when a law of nature is broken, it's a departure from a frequency that's so radical that you're much more forced to sit up and take notice than when it's what we call coincidental departure, right, from the norm. And therefore, we don't merit to see that kind of, we couldn't use such events, and we don't merit to see them these days. But we see the hidden kind all the time. Now that's one aspect of the nature of the fact that the world has a deeper reality, but the deeper reality is built only on the superficial reality. It's only by understanding the laws the way they function, and by observing the physical things the way they are physically, that you could ever have insight deeper. Of course, the deepest secret of all this is to understand the person. Because based on a human body, and a human intellect, and mind, and emotions, and structure in general, that's how the spiritual world, that's the deepest mystical axiom. That the only way to understand the world, to become what they call God conscious, or to achieve an understanding of the transcendent spheres, the only way to do that is to understand a human body and human function. Because the whole transcendent world is based on that pattern, exactly. But by looking at a person, you won't see it unless you know how to switch in. But if you know how to switch in, nothing could be more obvious. Now, let's try and use this idea to explore one fascinating application. Of course, there are many things, let's not leave it unsaid, there are many things in the physical world that need to be done in order to enhance the switching mechanism. How you relate to the world in a positive way enhances your ability to do it in the future. Mitzvahs. When a person does mitzvahs, and in specific, certain mitzvahs, they increase your sensitivity to have perception in this area. Certain mitzvahs are organized in such a way spiritually that they make the organs and parts move in the physical in such a way that they generate an insight into the spiritual. Huh? The food you eat, for example. What you eat has a special property of being able to, you know, it says that unkosher food is what's called matantara salaf. That means even if you don't know it's wrong, you don't get the damage for transgressing a commandment deliberately. But the heart becomes occluded. That's what it says. Metamtem esalev. It makes the heart, the spiritual heart, it makes it deadened and dull. It's an amazing thing. That's why certain animals have got this ability. The world was designed originally to be vegetarian. We once discussed this in detail. Today it's permitted to eat meat. But you have to know exactly what and how. And that's why people are very strict about certain things. Right? Not because of the transgression involved, apart from that, but because if you want to be sensitive to the spiritual world, and you train the vessel that's supposed to be sensitive, you take the lens and make it cloudy, it won't shine light clearly. The only lens you have is yours. You look through you. So if you put into that lens things that cloud the lens in the higher world, don't harm the body. Some of them harm the body also. It's another thing. But foods, some foods that don't harm the body, certain combinations of foods, a whole study. Some of these things occlude the lens. They obstruct. They make the lens opaque. That's why we take such care. One of the reasons we take such care to guard our sensitivity in so many different areas. What comes out of your mouth also. Just as important as what goes in. Now, let's take an application of this idea of using sensitivity and let's see something amazing. Rav Miller from Rav Dessler puts it this way, just a fascinating way in which to build our understanding of the subject. He says that there are four levels, trying to understand. Let's understand together. There are four levels of how a person can look at the dynamic tension between the natural and the supernatural world. It's possible to see that balance or that tension in four different ways. Four different levels of greatness, depending on your sensitivity. how sensitive you are and how much you want to be sensitive enables you to look at the physical world and see the inner being inside it. You can do that on four different levels. Let's try and understand these levels. It's the most remarkable insight. One of the greatest things ever written in this area is this wonderful insight into the spiritual world. He says the following thing. I think we've used this model, we've discussed it one or two occasions. Let's see if we can deepen our understanding. The first level, we start from the bottom up. By the way, I'm warning you that the experience is very embarrassing of trying to, what you should do while we're talking is place yourself where you are. Where are you holding? In these four levels, where are you personally holding? No, don't have to put your hand up. But where are you holding in terms of these four levels? Which level of sensitivity into the spiritual world have you personally generated for yourself? I'm warning you now, this embarrassing exercise. We'll start from the bottom, the easy level, and then we'll work our way to the more difficult levels of transcendence. So he says this, the first level is a person, on the first level, is an individual who relates to the physical and spiritual worlds in the following way. He davens to Hashem, that's the first level. It's a person who's already praying, that's already speaking directly to the Creator. That's the first, the lowest level, right? It's somebody who knows, he already has consciousness of Hashem's existence, and many, many details of what that means. And he relates to it personally all the time. That's the lowest level. We're not talking about people who still think they're gorillas. We're talking about people who've already, right, let's say, evolved out of that stage. So this is an individual who does the following. He davens to Hashem as follows. Now, what we understand is, how does he phrase his speech? How does he relate to the spiritual world that shows his understanding of what's going on between the physical manifestation of Hashem's presence and Hashem's spiritual being? That means, how does Hashem control what's going on here? How does Hashem get involved in the physical world? How deeply enmeshed is Hashem's presence in the physical world? That's what we want to understand. Right? Is he here or is he not here? Is he totally part of this world or is he not? Is he imbuing every molecule of your own being as well as everything around you, or isn't he? So this person on this level, the first level of growth, spiritual growth, he understands it as follows. He davens to Hashem in the following way. He says, Hashem, let me give you an example. Let's say this individual has an important meeting a week from now. Let's say 10 o'clock next Monday morning, let's say he's got an important meeting someplace. And he wants to make that meeting very badly. A lot of his future depends on that thing. So he davens to Hashem like this. Hashem, please let it happen. Right? That means, I'm going to make that meeting. Right? I'm going to do everything I have to do to get there. I'm going to make all the moves. I'm going to transport myself from here to there. The other person will do the same thing. And at the point of time, we'll meet. We'll discuss what we have to discuss, and with a bit of luck, so the result will be what I need. But he says, Hashem, please allow it. Let it happen. What he means is this. The words reflect it very painfully. What he means by let it happen, and you can phrase it in many different ways, but what he's expressing is the following thing. The physical world is real. That's what he understands. I'm real. The means of transport that I'll use to get me there, all the events that are going to happen between now and next Monday morning are real. The other individual is real. We control our own destinies. That means the forces of nature and physics and so forth, and psychology and everything else, they motivate and move everything that's happening. And if all goes well, I'll get there and we'll have this discussion. But it's provided one thing, that Hashem doesn't interfere. That's what he means. That means he knows about Hashem. He knows he's all-powerful. That's the lowest level. He knows Hashem is all-powerful, that he created the world, that he's master of the world, he can do whatever he wants. He knows all that. But he understands that Hashem relates to the world in such a way that he allows it to run on its own steam according to the laws that he set up. And when he wants, he interferes. Are you with me? In terms of last week's discussion, it would be a person who understands that there are mechanisms that are projecting weapons of destruction to certain targets, and Hashem is deflecting them into unoccupied spaces. That's what he would understand. That's what we've been there to see until now, as we pointed out last week. So things haven't changed this week. Unfortunately, they haven't changed for the better either, which means we're not doing our job properly. But so far, we've been there to see that. Now, it means this. So, are you with me? So, we have here a natural world. This person believes in a natural world. He believes that there's a world that's real and natural, and the forces that operate make it operate. Only Hashem can override it whenever he wants. What's wrong with this level? What's wrong with this level is something very, very wrong. What's wrong with it is that he doesn't ascribe totality of existence and oneness to Hashem. He understands that Hashem is, but there's a world outside of him, below his level of reality. There's a world that's self-contained, that's isolated in its own dimension. And in that world, things happen because the forces, the causes, cause the effects. Hashem and his world can interfere, but he's not one and the same. Are you with me? He's not one and the same as the physical world. So he divorced Hashem from the world. Which means, first of all, that he's divorced him from us. Secondly, that the oneness of Hashem's totality is not true by him, because Hashem is one there, but not here. That's what's wrong with that level. It's okay to start with that level. A person has to start someplace, but it has that fault. What's the second level? The second level is much more elevated than this. The second level is somebody who understands that the world is not separate from Hashem. Everything that happens physically in the world is directly caused by Hashem. Every molecule that vibrates, every atom that spins, is directly done by Hashem every millisecond of the time. There's no such thing as causes causing effects. Every cause is Hashem. That's a much more elevated state of consciousness. That person understands when anything happens in the world, it's Hashem doing it. Are you with me? Not that there's something left to run by itself, but the root of existence, that core of the being of the world, is directly causing what's happening. He doesn't see a leaf fall from a tree without understanding that Hashem directly caused that leaf to fall, immediately and directly. In other words, but the problem is this. So what's nature? So what is nature? What is nature? Let's face it, when you look at nature, you don't see Hashem doing things. This person doesn't fool himself. He looks at nature and sees nature. So what is nature? It looks real. So he understands that nature is a tool that Hashem uses. It's what's called a kli b'yada boirei. Nature is a tool that Hashem uses to teach you what he wants to teach you, to give you a place to be, all the things that Hashem needs in the world. He uses the laws of physics, he uses everything that he does in the world as a tool, but the tool is directly in his hand. Not like the first person who thinks he wound it up and let it run, and occasionally he interferes. This person understands that Hashem's wielding the tool all the time. It does not flinch except that Hashem himself moves it. What's wrong with this individual? What's wrong with this level? Not bad, that level. Doesn't miss Hashem's existence for a second. That person would never think that he's going to get himself to that meeting, right, between now and next week, that he's going to get himself there. Right? Unlike the first person, who thinks that it's the laws of nature that will get him there. Only there's so many things that can go wrong between now and next Monday. That's his only problem. Right? You follow? That's his only problem. Hashem just don't let them go. That's the way that kind of person thinks on the first level. You know that the chances of you getting to a meeting next Monday at 10 o'clock are very slim. You know that? Do you know how many things can get, how many microbes can get in between? How many viruses can get in between you and the meeting next Monday morning? You know how many things, right? How many, there are billions of freaks of nature that could get between you and what you want next Monday morning. Of course, any one of them is very unlikely, but all of them put together are not that unlikely. Therefore, you just don't want Hashem to interfere. That means, Hashem, do me a favor. Just take care of the freak things that could get in the way. That's what he means. The second person, the person on the second level, never thinks that way at all. He understands that there is no such thing, that any microbe, any virus, whatever happens, Hashem is doing himself. What's wrong with it? Now, we're getting more subtle now, okay? What's wrong with that is as follows. The problem with someone using a tool, he thinks that Hashem is using nature as a tool. The problem with someone using a tool is as follows. A tool always implies a deficiency of the one who uses the tool. Let's change these things together because I'm going to drive me crazy. The problem is this, that if someone understands that Hashem is using nature as a tool, so then he understands that there's some deficiency in the level of what we call Hashem. Because a tool is always an extension of yourself where you can't reach without the tool. No one ever uses a tool where they can reach without the tool. A simple example that does not actually himself uses is this. He says, if you ever, sometimes you go into some people's bathrooms, and there you see on the side of the bath a long object like this with a plastic sort of hand like that at the end. Sometimes it's got a sponge in. You know what that thing's for? It's for washing your back. Nobody washes their stomach with that thing. The only reason you use that to wash your back with is because you can't get there without it. That's why you devise a tool like that. It doesn't make any difference if you're the one who invented the tool. Are you with me? Nevertheless, you only use the tool where you can't reach yourself. And of course it has a broader application also. If you run a shop, for example, or a business, and the business expands to a point through your own cleverness, let's say, you expand the business to a point where you can't cope on your own. So you take in help. You take in, but it's only because you can't manage it yourself. You follow me? Even though it's your own genius that might have got you there, but nevertheless, when things expand to a point in space or time or whatever, that you can't reach there yourself, you have to use something that's not you, but is an extension of you. Even if you do it yourself, and you use it yourself, and you control it yourself, and even if you make it yourself, like Hashem makes nature himself, but nevertheless, he must need this thing for some reason. Are you with me? It implies that if he wants to teach us something, he wants to teach it through trees and rocks and nature and physical laws and so forth, he must need that. So he doesn't do it himself, he creates this whole thing. And he uses that to do whatever it is that he does. But it's not him. It's something that he's using. So the problem here with this person is, first of all, of course, the basic problem that there are two things. There's Hashem and his tools. And secondly, deeper than that, there's an implication implied that there must be a deficiency someplace that stops Hashem manifesting himself, as it were, right? And yet, and causes him to... What's the third level? Now this is much more difficult. The third level is someone who's already risen beyond the first two stages. He doesn't have these problems. His spiritual insight is much sharper and deeper, and he relates to Hashem in the following way. He knows that nature is not something that Hashem uses. It is Hashem. Again, this person, let's hear carefully. This person doesn't understand that there's Hashem in the spiritual world, using the natural world, investing it, using it like a hand in a glove. No, there is no glove. What he witnesses is Hashem directly. He's not causing a leaf to fall, he is that leaf falling. Are you with me? There's no extension of Hashem. There's no tool. There is only oneness. There is only Hashem's oneness. That's what he understands. Now, obviously, the problem is this. Now, obviously, the problem is, so what's nature? It doesn't look that way. You're telling me that Hashem is a oneness and he's manifest all the time? I don't see that. The person on the third level is fooling himself. We're not talking about an idiot. We're not talking about someone who's hypnotized himself into believing that everything's one thing when he can see it isn't. We're not talking about that. We're talking about somebody who sees more clearly than you and I do. Well, I'll tell you in a moment who are the people on this level and who they were. You'll see that people much, much greater than we are. They don't fool themselves. They see nature too, just like you and I do. So how do they understand nature? That's the problem. If they know that there's nothing that really is what the world looks like, but it's all Hashem's oneness, why does it look like it's not like that? Are you with me? That's their problem. How do they resolve that? They understand the following. They understand this, that actually, in reality, there is only oneness. There is only Hashem's oneness. There's no me, there's no you, there's no up, there's no down, there's no black, there's no white. It's just Hashem's one manifestation. What is nature? It's a smokescreen. It's an illusion that he creates so you shouldn't see his oneness. Why did he do that, and how did he do it? A smokescreen is a real thing, by the way. Have to understand carefully what we mean by an illusion. We don't mean it isn't real. Nature out there can hurt you very badly if you don't use it correctly. You have to be aware. It doesn't mean you're supposed to pretend it isn't there. It is there. Just like a smokescreen is there. The smokescreen is. But it's only there to hide. That's the only reason that it's there. This person understands that Hashem created a thing that's called nature. He manifests himself in such a way that you can get used to what's happening in such a way that you think it's something independent. Why? So that you don't see him. Why is that? That's a long discussion in its own right. I'll just refer to it briefly. It's not tonight's subject. It's in order to give you free will. One of the main mechanisms that you have free will in the world is because you don't see Hashem directly. If you saw Hashem directly, you would never do anything wrong. If you saw Hashem manifest directly at all times, you never could hurt another person. You could never be inconsiderate to another person's feelings. Because first of all, that is Hashem. And second of all, the consequence you experience immediately, there's no time. In the dimension of Hashem's existence, there's no time, there's no cause and effect, it's all one thing. So you could never do anything wrong, which means you could never activate, bring out your own personality. You never could work on yourself and develop, and that's what he wants us to do. Why and how we know that is a long discussion on free will, which we have to have some other time. But let's just take that for granted at the moment. We can't do everything at once. Let's take that for granted for the moment. He wants a smokescreen to give you freedom. Of course it says as the messianic age approaches, and we mentioned this before, the smokescreen gets thinner and thinner. Cause and effect become more and more closely related. That's what we're experiencing now. The results of negative behavior are becoming more immediately apparent than they ever were before. Various mechanisms. Interesting discussion. But there's always, in this world, a smokescreen, an illusion. Now, that's what this person understands.
Now.
Who are these people? Somebody living on this level has a unique characteristic. In case you think you've reached this level, you might think, and maybe you have, I don't know you. Maybe you have reached the level where you're on this level, so you can check it out. There's a test. The test of somebody, whether they have reached this level, is that where this person is, nature does not exist. Not that he thinks it doesn't exist. It does not exist. Surrounding this person are miracles all the time. Why? Understand. This is the level of the Tanoim, Lamaroim. After the year, approximately about 1700 years ago, we haven't had people. We've had individuals. But when it was widespread, was in the days of the Tanoim. There were many, many examples brought down in the Gemara. People who did miracles, like, was the easiest thing in the world for them. In fact, there's a big problem. The Baal HaLashon discusses why there are so many more miracles discussed in Talmudic times that happened than even in Tanakh times. That's a fascinating discussion. Perhaps we'll come back to that sometime. But in times of the Talmud, the Gemara, you have people who did miracles very easily. They perform miracles. They change nature. Many, many times. Many times. Why? How? Oh, the Gemara says that resurrection of the dead, to revive the dead, happened a number of times in the Gemara. Tanakh, it only happened twice or three times. Once by Elisha, twice by Eliyahu, vice versa. It's the only time you'll find it in Tanakh, that someone was able to revive someone who had died. But the Gemara is full of it. In the Gemara, it's no problem. The Gemara says, I'll just give you one or two examples. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was friendly with Antoninus, the Caesar, king of Rome. In English, they call him conventional name Marcus Aurelius. Gemara calls him Antoninus. And you can read his writings, by the way, things that he learned from Rabbi. Very interesting relationship they had. They were friends. But anyway, Rabbi, when he was an old man, was friendly with this man, Marcus Aurelius, and he used to come and visit him. The Caesar used to come and visit Rabbi through a hidden tunnel that led from his royal residence into Rabbi's, where Rabbi was. The Gemara says he used to come secretly because of the Roman to be seen visiting the leading sage of the nation that they had subjugated, obviously was unacceptable. He used to come privately and secretly. He used to take two slaves with him, the Gemara says. He used to kill one when he arrived at Rabbi's place, and he used to kill the other when he got back. There's no evidence. He went accompanied, like a king always does. When he got to Rabbi's door, he killed the one, left him dead outside. He spoke to Rabbi. When he got home, he killed the other one. That was it. Now, one day it says that he got to the door of the tunnel, he killed his slave, left him dead in the passage, went inside to Rabbi, and he saw he wasn't alone. Rabbi was there with one of his young students. One of the Tanoim, one of the young students of Rabbi's Beis Medrash, was there. The Gemara says, I think it's Daf Yuma. Yuma, Daf Yud. I'm with Aleph or Beis, I don't remember. You can look it up in the Gemara. He says over there, the Gemara says, he walked into the room and he found Rabbi wasn't alone. So he said to Rabbi, didn't I tell you that I never want to be seen with people? I want to see you only privately. So Rabbi tried to put him off. He said, Lay stain bar Inish, he's not human. Rabbi said, don't worry about this man, he's not human. But Marcus Aurelius wasn't impressed, so he tried to get rid of this student. So he said to him, do me a favor, go and call in my slave. He wanted him to call in the dead slave. He thought they would take him quite a while, with enough time to talk to Rabbi. So it says that the Talmud went outside into the passage and he found the dead man. So he had a dilemma, because to disobey the king, right, he couldn't bring him in. To not bring him in is disobedience to a king's order. That's a very, very major problem. That's not a covert for the Malchus at all. On the other hand, to schlep in a corpse, he felt, was not becoming either. So it says, Boy Rachmei V'achye, he davened and brought him back to life. He brought him back to life and he took him in. And it says that Antoninus wasn't in the least impressed. He said to Rabbi, I'm not impressed with that. I know that the smallest in your base medrash could do that. Remarkable thing. And the Gemara's got other examples. The Gemara's got plenty of examples. There was a case when amazing thing, Rav Kahana, I think it was Rav Yochanan, Rav Kahana came to Eretz Yisrael to the Amoraim even. Not just the Tanoim, even the days of the Amoraim. It says he was sitting at the back and he asked a question and the Rebbe couldn't answer it, so they brought him one row forward and he asked another question, he couldn't answer. Finally he ended up in front and finally he asked a question that he couldn't answer, so they put his pillows down, they raised him up, and he asked another question. He stuck. So it says for the first time he opened his eyes to see who this man was. He had big bushy eyebrows. He opened his eyes to see who this man was asking him these questions that he couldn't answer. And he saw a man whom he thought was smiling at him. Because it says that Kahana, I think of Yochanan, I can't remember, had always an expression where his mouth was always open. He thought he was smiling at him. So he looked at him in such a way that he died. He died. So it says they buried him. And then somebody mentioned to him that he wasn't laughing at you. This is a Gemara, you have to understand this. This is deep mystical wisdom, you have to understand. Not playing games, you don't want to tell jokes. Somebody pointed out that he hadn't been laughing at him. He just always had that expression. He said, oi, that's how he ran out to the grave. And he brought him out. He brought him up. So Rav Kahana, I think it was Rav Kahana, so he got up and he said, listen, I didn't realize you weren't laughing at me. Let's go back to town. So he said, no. He said, I died once. It's enough. I'm staying here. So the Gemara says he asked him all the kashas he had in Gemara. He asked him all the difficulties he had in learning. And he went back. And he went back to town. There's a Gemara. It's a Gemara. There's many Gemaras like that. There's many other examples. It's getting late. I'll just share one with you. There's an amazing Gemara that says, and by the way, these Gemaras aren't brought to show you the miraculous. They're brought because they're illustrating something else. It just so happens that something happened miraculous along the way. There's a Gemara, we haven't time to go into it now, right now. But there's many, many cases. There's a Tana, Chanina ben Joisa. He put his foot over the hole of a certain reptile whose bite was a formidable, a bite was so lethal, no one could survive it. He put his foot over to show that snakes don't kill, sin kill, and touch it. There were cases, many, many cases. One fascinating case, the Gemara says that a man called Mar Ukva was an Amoira who used to give charity to a certain man. He used to put stock in this man's house, privately. He used to move off before the man could ever see who gave him the money. So one day the Gemara says he was walking past this man's house with his wife, and he dropped money inside this man's house so the man couldn't see it. And as he did that, the door opened. The man wanted to see who it was who was benefiting him like this. So Mar Ukva and his wife started to run away because they didn't want to be guilty of embarrassing a person that he should know who was giving him the money that he needed. And they ran like anything to avoid being identified by this man who was chasing him. But he was gaining on them. And the Gemara says the only place to hide was in a fire. There was an oven, a baker's oven. You know, one of those big, a baker's oven, a light. The only place to hide. So they went into the oven, they closed the door. Wait till the man went. And they stood in the fire, they stood in the oven, no problem. Then the Gemara says, I'm just telling you this by the way. Usually makes the ladies feel good. While Mar Ukva stood in the oven, it says his feet started to get hot. They were standing on a red hot, yeah. His feet started to get hot. But what upset him badly was the fact that his wife's feet weren't getting hot at all. When she saw that his feet were getting hot, she said, stand on my feet. The woman said he stood on her feet. And he was very upset. You know, Mar Ukva, you may be sure, worked on himself tremendously. Not that he held anything against his wife's level, but he held that he'd worked on himself. I'm not talking with pride, but he worked on himself. Why was it that he wasn't subject? That's a long story. I don't want to take too much time. It turns out she was on a higher level for a certain reason. You might say she went into certain practical, she did mitzvahs in a certain practical way, and therefore down to the bottom of her feet she'd made her body sanctified to a level of it. A remarkable thing. Mar Ukva, that's a very beautiful Gemara. Mar Ukva used to give money. It means, briefly I'll tell you, the Gemara says this, he said to her, why your feet not hot? She said, it's because I give mitzvahs, I do mitzvahs. The way she put it was, when poor people come to the door for food, I give them food, I give them a meal. And Rashi on that Gemara says bread and salt. Remarkable thing. What does this mean? She gives them food and Rashi says it means bread and salt. It's a beautiful thing to be able to understand a piece of Gemara. But what it means is this. What she was trying to tell him is this. You as a male, you always do things that are at the beginning of a process. A male always does that. He puts in the spark that will be something one day. But he never finishes it off. Right? That's the male nature. It's the whole thing we have to discuss another time. But the female nature is not putting a spark in. The female nature is taking the spark and making it happen, making it real. She takes the action to the end. Right? The male begins the spark of a child, the woman makes the child and gives birth to it. That's what it is. So she said, you do mitzvahs in such a way, you give potential, you don't give actual. For example, you give money. You give this poor man money. But he's got to take the money and go do. He's got to go buy food. When people come to me, I give the food. I take the mitzvah down to its... In other words, I actualize the mitzvah. Rashi says bread and salt. He means every last detail. That's what she meant. And since I take the mitzvah down to its grassroots, down to its physical expression in the practical real world, my body has been sanctified down to the bottom of my structure. It's a remarkable thing. It's a deep secret what it means, man, woman, but that's another story. Anyway, the Gemara brings it just to show you the fact that they survived in a fire is completely incidental to that Gemara. Completely incidental. It's unusual. And the Gemara is full of these kind of things. Now, I think of Chanina himself one day he wanted to light the Shabbat candles and he called for oil and there wasn't any oil. So he said, doesn't matter, bring vinegar. They had vinegar now. So they brought vinegar and he lit the vinegar. So people said to him, but you can't do that. So he said, why not? Let the one who says oil should burn, let him say vinegar should burn. Why doesn't bother me? Hashem can make oil burn, he can make vinegar burn. So lit the vinegar. The inner meaning of all this is as follows, that people living on the third level can do these things because of the following reasons. If nature is a smokescreen, if it's a mask, right? If nature is a mask, which is what the mystics say it is, there's no point where, you have to understand deeply, let's say you say you're in a certain place. One of your friends comes into the room and he's wearing a disguise. It's that friend of yours, he's playing a joke on you. So he comes in with a mask on and he starts teasing you with his mask. And you can't see who he is. You can't see through the mask, you don't know who it is. Let's say after a while you realize who it is and you identify from certain, you know who the person is. You're not going to keep the mask on anymore. There's no point wearing a mask when the other person sees through it. You only wear a mask to hide who you are. But if the person can see through the mask, there's no point wearing it anymore. So the mystics say that Hashem wears nature as a smokescreen only for those who can't see through it. But the person who can see through it, Hashem takes it off. There's no point hiding himself from somebody who can see him already. Hashem pretends to be bound by the laws of nature, and he won't let anything happen to you that's unnatural unless you see so clearly that there's no difference between natural and supernatural, and then there is no difference. Not because you're a great mystic cabalist who can make things levitate, but because Hashem stops fooling you if there's no point in being fooled. Are you with me? Rav Chanina could see that oil burns only because Hashem says so. You follow? We think oil burns because it's a combustible mixture of hydrocarbons like this and like this. That's what you think combines with oxygen and it burns. Vinegar, of course, never could burn. But as long as you've got an inkling of that in your mind, vinegar never could burn. But Rav Chanina never thought that way. He knew that oil burns because it's Hashem's answer, and Hashem wants oil to burn. And if Hashem wants vinegar to burn, it's absolutely no difference. Of course, had vinegar burnt, you would have had a beautiful chemical explanation for why vinegar burned. Not a problem. You would have just phrased your law that way. That's all. He knew that. So for a person like that, Hashem doesn't bother to make nature function one way or another. Are you with me? Makes no difference. You're not achieving anything with such an individual. Takes off the mask. It's a very, very beautiful idea. Finally, what's the fourth level? What's the fourth level? What's wrong with this level? For those of you who hold it. What's the fourth level? It says a very, very beautiful. This is a very, very deep and subtle and beautiful point. There's nothing wrong with the third level. There's nothing wrong. But the person on the fourth level has an added dimension to his neshama, and it's like this. The person on the fourth level knows that nature is a smokescreen. He knows it's a mask, he's seen through the mask, he's seen it taken off, he knows all that. But he's bothered intensely by a certain problem. He's bothered incessantly and intensely by a certain problem. Hear this well, the most beautiful, beautiful idea. He knows that there's a spiritual principle that everything was created in the world to reveal Hashem. It says, Akol Bara Lichvoida. Everything in the world was created to reveal Hashem's, it's very hard to translate, the word kavod means his honor, his glory. Actually, the technical translation is the malchus, which means the mystical sphere of Hashem's revelation. Whatever that means. But it means that everything was created to reveal Hashem's presence. That's the principle. So he goes around with this idea from his Torah that he's learned, that I call Bara Lichvoida. Everything that Hashem does in the world is to reveal his glory and his honor. And nature hides it. And that's what he can't handle. He knows, are you with me? He knows that everything was created only to reveal Hashem's presence. But he can't understand nature. Because although he sees through nature, doesn't fool him. But he can't understand why there's a smokescreen. He can't understand for the life of him why if everything was created for Hashem's honor, there should be something that should be created to hide Hashem or break the rules. So this individual, when he sees the smokescreen of nature, it's the most amazing miracle to him that Hashem could do such an unnatural thing. Hashem, who is one at all times and places, that he should be able to do something that negates that all-encompassing reality and existence, is the most incredible miracle. And in fact, this is just an expression of a Kabbalistic principle that the real creation is the creation of darkness. What Hashem really creates is the lenses or the filters that hide his being. That's what he really creates. His own being, the light of his being, he doesn't create, that is. What he creates is the darkness. That's what he creates. That's why it says, Yetzer Oyer V'yirei Choshech. He creates darkness. He creates darkness so you can see a bit of the light. It's an incredible world of paradox. If you try and look at the sun without a filter, you can't see the sun. The only way to see the sun is to darken it. It's a remarkable thing spiritually. So in order for Hashem to let you see some of the light, if he would let you see him, you'd be blasted out and fried instantaneously. So he creates a screen that leaves only the tiniest spark of Hashem's existence, which looks like a human being, or a tree, or some aspect of nature. To enable you to see it, he blots it out. But that's an incredible paradox. That is the most miraculous creation. In other words, this person, when he sees nature, to him it's the most amazing miracle. And when he sees a miracle, it's the most natural thing imaginable. Because when he sees a miracle and nature disappears and dissolves, he's happy. That's the world the way it should be. I call Baruch Vodoy. Where no rules operate and Hashem himself is perceived directly. To him, that's nature. So the person on the fourth level, it's an amazing idea. The person on the fourth level is the person to whom miracles are perfectly natural, and the natural world is absolutely miraculous. It's very, very remarkable. Let's leave it there for this evening.